Hello. Welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thank you for tuning in. Today we will continue our reading of Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome. It was published in 1889, became an instant success, and has never been out of print. The book has been categorized as a comic travelogue, perhaps the first. As our musical touchstone to accompany this reading, we will use Peter Dawson's rendition of Old Father Thames, recorded in 1933. There will be 17 episodes in this presentation, read to you by Bruce Carlson. Please join me now for episode 6 of Three Men in a Boat.
Poor girls. They had better have put up with me. The man they had got now was a jolly, light-hearted, thick-headed sort of chap with about as much sensitiviness in him as there might be in a Newfoundland puppy. He might look daggers at him for an hour, and he would not notice it, and it would not trouble him if he did. He set a good, rollicking, dashing stroke that sent the spray playing all over the boat like a fountain, and made the whole crowd sit up straight in no time. When he spread more than a pint of water over one of those dresses, he would give a pleasant little laugh and say, "I beg your pardon, I'm sure," and offer them his handkerchief to wipe it off with. "Oh, it's of no consequence," the poor girls would murmur in reply, and covertly draw rugs and coats over themselves, and try to protect themselves with their lace parasols. At lunch they had a very bad time of it. People wanted them to sit on the grass, and the grass was dusty, and the tree trunks against which they were invited to lean did not appear to have been brushed for weeks. So they spread their handkerchiefs on the ground and sat on those, bolt upright. Somebody, in walking about with a plate of pie, tripped up over a root and sent the pie flying. None of it went over them, fortunately, but the accident suggested a fresh danger to them and agitated them. And whenever anybody moved about after that, with anything in his hand that could fall and make a mess, they watched that person with growing anxiety until he sat down again. "Now then, you girls," said our friend the bow to them cheerily after it was all over, "come along and you've got to wash up." They didn't understand him at first. When they grasped the idea, they said they feared they did not know how to wash up. "Oh, I'll soon show you," he cried. "It's rare fun. You lie down on your, you lean over the bank, you know, and slouch the things about in the water." The elder sisters said that she was afraid she hadn't got on dresses suited to the work. "Oh, they'll be all right," he said lightheartedly. "Tuck 'em up." And he made them do it, too. He told them that that sort of thing was half the fun of a picnic. They said it was very interesting. "Now I come to think it over, was that young man as dense-headed as we thought? Or was he impossible? There was such a simple, childlike expression about him." Harris wanted to get out at Hampton Church to go see Mrs. Thomas's tomb. "Who is Mrs. Thomas?" I asked. "How should I know?" replied Harris. "She's a lady that's got a funny tomb, and I want to see it." I objected. "I don't know whether it is that I am built wrong, but I never did seem to hanker after tombstones myself. I know that the proper thing to do when you get to a village or town is to rush off to the churchyard and enjoy the graves. But it is a recreation that I always deny myself. I take no interest in creeping round dim and chilly churches behind wheezy old men and reading epitaphs. Not even the sight of a bit of cracked brass let into a stone affords me what I call real happiness. I shock respectable sextons by the imperturbability I am able to assume before exciting inscriptions, and by my lack of enthusiasm for the local family history, while my ill-concealed anxiety to get outside wounds their feelings. One golden morning of a sunny day, I leant against the low stone wall that guarded the little village church. I drank in deep, calm gladness from the sweet, restful scene, the gray old church with its clustering ivy and its quaint, carved wooden porch, the white lane winding down the hill between tall rows of elms, the thatched roof cottages peeping out above their trim-kept hedges, the silver river in the hollow, the wooded hills beyond. It was a lovely landscape. It was idyllic, poetic, and it inspired me. I felt good and noble. I felt I didn't want to be sinful and wicked anymore. I could come and live here and never do any more wrong, and lead a blameless, beautiful life, and have silver hair when I got old, and all that sort of thing. In that moment, I forgave all my friends and my relations for their wickedness and cussedness, and I blessed them. They did not know that I blessed them. They went their abandoned way, all unconscious of what I, far away in that peaceful village, was doing for them. But I did it, and I wish that I could let them know that I had done it, because I wanted to make them happy. I was going on thinking away all these grand, tender thoughts when my reverie was broken in upon by a shrill, piping voice crying out, "All right, sir, I'm a-coming, I'm a-coming. It's all right, sir, don't you be in a hurry." I looked up and saw an old, bald-headed man hobbling across the churchyard towards me, carrying a huge bunch of keys in his hand that shook and jingled at every step. I motioned him away with silent dignity, but he still advanced, screeching out the while, "I'm a-comin', sir, I'm a-comin'. I'm a little lame, I ain't as spry as I used to be. This way, sir." "Go away, you miserable old man," I said. "I've come as soon as I could, sir," he replied. "My missus never see you till you was this minute. You follow me, sir." "Go away," I repeated. "Leave me before I get over the wall and slay you." He seemed surprised. "Don't you want to see the tombs?" he said. "No," I answered, "I don't. I want to stop here, leaning up against this gritty old wall. Go away and don't disturb me. I'm chock full of beautiful and noble thoughts, and I want to stop like this because it feels nice and good. Don't you come fooling about making me mad, chivying away all my better feelings with this silly tombstone nonsense of yours. Go away and get somebody to bury you cheap, and I'll pay half the expense." He was bewildered for a moment. He rubbed his eyes and looked hard at me. I seemed human enough on the outside. He couldn't make it out. He says, "You are a stranger in these parts. You don't live here." "No," I said, "I don't." "You wouldn't if I did." "Well then," he said, "you want to see the tombs, graves, folks have been buried? You know, coffins?" "You are a liar," I replied, getting roused. "I do not want to see tombs, not your tombs. Why should I? We have graves of our own, our family has. Why, my Uncle Podger has a tomb in Kensal Green Cemetery. That is the pride of all that countryside. And my grandfather's vault at the Bow is capable of accommodating 8 visitors, while my great-aunt Susan has a brick grave in Finchley Churchyard, with a headstone with a coffee pot sort of thing in biased relief upon it, and a 6-inch best white stone coping all the way around. That cost pounds. When I went to graves, it is to those places that I go and revel. I do not want other folks. When you yourself are buried, I will come and see yours. That is all I can do for you." The old man burst into tears. He said that one of the tombs had a bit of stone upon the top of it that had been said by some to be probably part of the remains of the figure of a man, and that another had some words carved upon it that nobody had ever been able to decipher. I still remained obdurate, and in broken-hearted tones he said, "Well, won't you come and see the memorial window?" I would not even see that, so he fired his last shot. He drew near and whispered hoarsely, "I've got a couple skulls down in the crypt," he said. "Come and see those. Oh, do come and see the skulls. You are a young man out for a holiday, and you want to enjoy yourself. Come and see the skulls." Then I turned and fled, and as I sped I heard him calling to me, "Oh, come and see the skulls! Come back and see the skulls!" Harris, however, revels in tombs and graves and epitaphs and monumental inscriptions, and the thought of not seeing Mrs. Thomas's grave made him crazy. He said he had looked forward to seeing Mrs. Thomas's grave from the first moment that the trip was proposed, said he wouldn't have joined it if it hadn't been for the idea of seeing Mrs. Thomas's tomb. I reminded him of George and how we had to get the boat up to Shepherdton by 5 o'clock to meet him, and then he went for George. Why was George to fool about all day and leave us to lug this lumbering old top-heavy barge up and down the river by ourselves to meet him? Why couldn't George come and do some work? Why couldn't he have the day off and come down with us? Bank be blowed! What good was he at the bank? "I never see him do any work there," continued Harris. "Whenever I go in, he sits behind a bit of glass all day, trying to look as if he was doing something. What's the good of a man behind a bit of glass? I have to work for my living. Why can't he work? What use is he there? And what's the good of their banks? They take your money, and then, when you draw a check, they send it back smeared all over with 'No effects. Refer to the drawer.' What's the good of that? That's the sort of trick they served me twice last week. I'm not going to stand it much longer. I shall withdraw my account. If he was here, he could go and see that tomb. I don't believe him at the bank at all. He's larking about somewhere, that's what he's doing, leaving us to do all the work. I'm going to get out and have an energy drink." I pointed out to him that we were miles away from a shop, and then he went on about the river, and what was the good of the river, and was everybody who came on the river to die of thirst? It is always best to let Harris have his head when he gets like this. Then he pumps himself out, and he's quiet afterwards. I reminded him that there was concentrated lemonade in the hamper and a gallon jar of water in the nose of the boat, and that the two only wanted mixing to make a cool and refreshing beverage. Then he flew off about lemonade and such like Sunday school slops, as he termed them, ginger beer and raspberry syrup, etc., etc. He said they all produced dyspepsia and ruined body and soul alike, and were the cause of half the crime in England. He said he must drink something, however, and climbed upon the seat and leaned over to get the bottle. It was right at the bottom of the hamper and seemed difficult to find, and he had to lean over further and further, and in trying to steer at the same time from a topsy-turvy point of view, he pulled the wrong line and sent the boat into the bank, and the shock upset him, and he dived right down into the hamper and stood there on his head, holding on to the sides of the boat like grim death, his legs sticking up in the air. He dared not move for fear of going over, and had to stay there till I could get hold of his legs and haul him back. That made him madder than ever. Chapter 8. We stopped under the willows by Kempton Park and lunched. It was a pretty little spot there, a pleasant grass plateau running along by the water's edge, overhung by willows. We had just commenced the third course, the bread and jam, when a gentleman in shirt sleeves and a short pipe came along and wanted to know if we knew that we were trespassing. We said we hadn't given the matter sufficient consideration as yet to enable us to arrive at a definite conclusion on that point, but that, if he assured us on his word as a gentleman that we were trespassing, we would, without further hesitation, believe it. He gave us the required assurance, and we thanked him, but he still hung about and seemed to be dissatisfied, so we asked him if there was anything further that we could do for him. And Harris, who is of a chummy disposition, offered him a bit of bread and jam. I fancy he must have belonged to some society sworn to abstain from bread and jam, for he declined it quite gruffly, as if he were vexed at being tempted with it, and he added that it was his duty to turn us off. Harris said that if it was his duty, it ought to be done, and asked the man what was his idea with regard to the best means for accomplishing it. Harris is what you would call a well-made man of about number one size, and looks hard and bony. And the man measured him up and down, and said he would go and consult his master, and then come back and chuck us both into the river. Of course, we never saw him any more, and, of course, all he really wanted was a shilling. There are a number of riverside roughs who make quite an income during the summer by slouching about the banks and blackmailing weak-minded noodles in this way. They represent themselves as sent by the proprietor. The proper course to offer your name and address and leave the owner, if he really has anything to do with the matter, to summon you and prove what damage you have done to his land by sitting down on a bit of it. But the majority of people are so intensely lazy and timid that they prefer to encourage the imposition by giving in to it rather than put an end to it by the exertion of a little firmness. Where it is really the owners that are to blame, they ought to be shown up. The selfishness of the riparian proprietor grows with every year. If these men had their way, they would close the River Thames altogether. They actually do this along the minor tributary streams and in the backwaters. They drive posts into the bed of the stream and draw chains across from bank to bank and nail huge notice boards on every tree. The sight of those notice boards rouses every evil instinct in my nature. I feel I want to tear each one down and hammer it over the head of the man who put it up until I have killed him, and then I would bury him and put the board up over the grave as a tombstone. I mentioned these feelings of mine to Harris, and he said he had them worse than that. He said he not only felt he wanted to kill the man who caused the board to be put up, but that he should like to slaughter the whole family and all his friends and relations, and then burn down his house. This seemed to me to be going too far, and I said so to Harris. But he answered, "Not a bit of it. Serve 'em all jolly well right, and I'd go and sing comic songs on the ruins." I was vexed to hear Harris go on in this bloodthirsty strain. We never ought to allow our instincts of justice to degenerate into mere vindictiveness. It was a long while before I could get Harris to take a more Christian view of the subject, but I succeeded at last, and he promised me that he would spare the friends and relations at all events, and would not sing comic songs on the ruins. You have never heard Harris sing a comic song, or you would understand the service I had rendered to mankind. It is one of Harris's fixed ideas that he can sing a comic song. The fixed idea, on the contrary, among those of Harris's friends who have heard him try, is that he can't and never will be able to, and that he ought not be allowed to try. When Harris is at a party and is asked to sing, he replies, "Well, I can only sing a comic song, you know," and he says it in a tone that implies that his singing of that, however, is a thing that you ought to hear once and then die. "Oh, that is nice," says the hostess. "Do sing one, Mr. Harris." And Harris gets up and makes for the piano with the beaming cheeriness of a generous-minded man who is just about to give somebody something. "Now, silence, please, everybody," says the hostess, turning around. "Mr. Harris is going to sing a comic song." "Oh, how jolly," they murmur, and they hurry in from the conservatory and come up from the stairs and go and fetch each other from all over the house and crowd into the drawing room and sit around, all smirking in anticipation. Then Harris begins. Well, you don't have to look for much of a voice in a comic song. You don't expect correct phrasing or vocalization. You don't mind if a man does find out, when in the middle of a note, that he is too high and comes down with a jerk. You don't bother about time. You don't mind a man being two bars in front of the accompaniment and easing up in the middle of a line to argue it out with the pianist, and then starting the verse afresh. But you do expect words. You don't expect a man to never remember more than the first three lines of the first verse, and to keep on repeating these until it's time to begin the chorus. You don't expect a man to break off in the middle of a line and snigger and say, "It's very funny, but he's blessed if he can think of the rest of it," and then try to make it up for himself, and afterwards suddenly recollect it when he has got to an entirely different part of the song and break off without a word of warning to go back and let you have it then and there. You don't, well, I just give you an idea of Harris's comic singing, and then you can judge it for yourself. Harris, standing up in front of a piano and addressing the expectant mob. "I'm afraid it's a very old thing, you know. I expect you all know it, you know. But it's the only thing I know. It's the judge's song out of Pinafore. No, I don't mean Pinafore. I mean, you know what I mean, the other thing, you know. You must all join in the chorus. You know it." Murmurs of delight and anxiety to join in the chorus. Brilliant performances of the prelude to the judge's song in Trial by Jury by Nervous Pianist. Moment arrives for Harris to join in. Harris takes no notice of it. Nervous Pianist commences prelude over again, and Harris, commencing singing at the same time, dashes off the first two lines of the First Lord's song out of Pinafore. Nervous Pianist tries to push on with the prelude, gives it up, and tries to follow Harris with accompaniment to Judge's song out of Trial by Jury. Finds that doesn't answer and tries to recollect what he's doing and where he is, and feels his mind giving away and stops short. Harris, with kindly encouragement, "It's all right. You're doing it very well indeed. Go on." The Nervous Pianist, "I'm afraid there's a mistake somewhere. What are you singing?" Harris, promptly, "Why, the judge's song out of Trial by Jury. Don't you know it?" Some friends of Harris, from the back of the room. "No, you're not, you chucklehead. You're singing the Admiral's song from Pinafore." Long argument pursues between Harris and Harris's friend as to what Harris is really singing. Friend finally suggests that it doesn't matter what Harris is singing, so long as Harris gets on and sings it. And Harris, with an evident sense of injustice rankling inside him, requests the pianist to begin again. Pianist, thereupon, starts the prelude to the Admiral's song, and Harris, seizing what he considers to be a favorable opening in the music, begins, "When I was young and called to the bar." General uproar of laughter taken by Harris as a compliment. Pianist, thinking of his wife and family, gives up the unequal contest and retires, his place being taken by a stronger-nerved man. The new pianist, cheerily. "Now then, old man, you start off and I'll follow. We won't bother about any prelude." Harris, upon whom the explanation of matters has slowly dawned laughingly, "By Jove, I beg your pardon, of course I've been mixing up the two songs. It was Jenkins confused me, you know. Now then. Singing, his voice appearing to come from the cellar and suggesting the first low warnings of an approaching earthquake. When I was young, I served a term as an office boy to an attorney's firm. Aside to the pianist. It is too low, old man. Well, have that part over again, if you don't mind. Sings the first two lines over again in a high falsetto this time. Great surprise on the part of the audience. Nervous old lady near the fire begins to cry and has to be let out. Harris, continuing. I swept the windows and I swept the door, and I... No, I cleaned the windows of the big front door, and I polished up the floor. No, dash it, I beg your pardon, funny thing, I can't think of that line. And get on to the chorus and chance it. Sings. And diddle 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 dee, till now I am the ruler of the Queen's Navy. Now then, chorus it is, the last two lines repeated, you know. General chorus. And he diddle 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 deed, till now he is the ruler of the Queen's Navy. And Harris never sees what an ass he's making of himself, and how he's annoying a lot of people who never did him any harm. He honestly imagines that he has given them a treat and says he will sing another comic song after supper. Speaking of comic songs and parties, reminds me of a rather curious incident at which I once assisted, which, as it throws much light upon the inner mental workings of human nature in general, I ought, I think, to be recorded in these pages. We were a fashionable and highly cultured party. We had on our best clothes, and we talked pretty, and were very happy all except two young fellows, students, just returned from Germany. Commonplace young men, who seemed restless and uncomfortable, as if they found the proceeding slow. The truth was, we were too clever for them. Our brilliant but polished conversation and our high-class tastes were beyond them. They were out of place among us. They never ought to have been there at all. Everybody agreed upon that later. We played Morceau from old German masters. We discussed philosophy and ethics. We flirted with graceful dignity. We were even humorous in a high-class way.
You have been listening to Episode 6 of Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome. Please remember that if you miss an episode, you can find it by going to our website, ktwh.org, and clicking on Programs, and then Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down list. Each week, we will post the episodes from the prior 2 weeks for you to catch up on. Please join me next time for Episode 7 of Three Men in a Boat, here on Literally from the North Shore. Down to the mighty sea. What does he know? What does he care? Nothing for you or me. Old Father Thames keeps rolling along.